Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Ready? One, two, three, four!
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, that's right, the Iditarod, a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and before we jump into today's episode, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Alaska Public Media and KNOM are again teaming up to bring you coverage of the last great race. We'll have a few of these podcasts leading up to the race start on March 3rd. Then we'll switch over to a daily podcast and have a new episode every morning with the latest news straight from the Iditarod Trail. This year, just like last year, we'll have two reporters on the trail. One is Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes. The other is KNOM's news director, Davis Hovey. In our last episode, we talked to Zach and our other trail reporter from last year, Ben Matheson, about the 2017 race, kind of a look back. If you haven't had a chance, check out your podcast feed for that installment of the Iditapod. Today, there's a different special guest with us in the studio, Anchorage Daily News Iditarod reporter Tegan Hanlon. Hi, Tegan.
Hey, guys.
And of course, we are also joined by our trail reporter, Zach, who is special in his own right.
Thank you. Thank you, Casey.
So in this episode, we're going to get into some of the Iditarod's off-season controversy this year. We had, in October, the naming of a former Iditarod champion, Dallas Seavey, as the musher whose dogs tested positive for a banned substance in the race last year.
Tramadol.
At the end of the race last year.
Probably all learned what tramadol was.
We found out what tramadol was.
True.
There was also, in the meantime here, we had a report from the 4-Acre Group, a consultant that recommended some things to the Iditarod.
Yeah, and painted a very bleak picture about the Iditarod's future. So I think we'll be definitely touching on that.
Maybe getting into the possibility that sponsors would be pulling out. And related to that report, we also had the Iditarod Official Finishers Club demanding that Andy Baker, the board president, resign. And then we want to talk a little bit, too, about People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. They have maybe gained more traction this year. And they are also, I guess, planning on coming up for the start of the race. And I think for the finish, too, in Nome, right?
Yes.
I think so.
Yeah. So call it three, maybe four different kind of big events that are weighing down on the race. And I think it's really hard to talk about the 2018 Iditarod and the days and weeks ahead without sort of mentioning that there are not one, but kind of three black clouds hanging over the event.
Getting into what's been called a dog doping scandal. This started before Dallas Seavey's name really ever came out. It was about a rule change, right? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so I think it started around the first week in October, and the Iditarod Board of Directors came out with a statement that said there were some dogs on a 2017 Iditarod team that tested positive for a prohibited drug, so we're going to change the rules. It didn't name the musher, didn't name the drug, didn't say how many dogs were tested, and the Iditarod told us they couldn't tell us those details. Because since they couldn't penalize the musher, there was like some legal concerns with releasing that information.
So the rule change was what exactly?
So they made mushers strictly liable for any positive drug tests in the future. In the past, it was up to Iditarod officials to prove intent in the case of a positive drug test. They'd have to prove that the musher intentionally gave this drug to the dogs. Now, if you're a musher and your dogs test positive for a drug, you're responsible of proving that you had nothing to do with it.
And from that, it feels like it really sort of trickled out in this weird way where people were reading into that rule change that a musher violated the rule, but they didn't say who the musher was. And so people began speculating. And I remember feeling like, well, aren't you going to tell us?
Yeah. So it was a big deal because it was the first positive drug test since they started testing dogs in 1994. And so a week went by and no one heard anything. There was speculation among mushers, among the public.
Among reporters in our newsroom.
Yeah. Everyone just wanted to know who and what happened. There was just this like little sliver of information and nothing else. So the Iditarod came out with a second statement. And this statement said that the dogs tested positive for tramadol and they tested positive after they finished the race.
What's the implication here? I mean, tramadol is a synthetic opioid. What advantage could a musher get from giving their dog something like this?
I think that was part of why people were so curious was, you know, it was not, it's not something that is a commonly held performance enhancer in the mushing community or at large. People, I remember people sort of speculating that maybe the musher used it to get his dogs to not, you know, be experiencing pain so they looked better coming over the finish line, or to just trudge on to get them across, or maybe afterwards therapeutically. I mean, you know, eventually it got to this point where Musher X was named as Dallas. Dallas CV, it almost like couldn't be a more ridiculous person for it to have come out about. And by which I mean, he's mushing's kind of golden child. He's won 4 times, very prominent. It was a total head scratcher. And I remember calling mushers in reporting afterwards who were just kind of like, I don't think he did it. And he denied he did it. And why would he have done it? You know, the motive wasn't there. And it really was a very interesting and curious sort of doping scandal to unfold, where there was just scandals within scandals about how it was handled and why it happened the way it did, and what it could have been. And was it intentional? Was it sabotage? And we still don't know.
And to be clear, and the board has said this since then, they never said that Dallas in particular, you know, personally drugged his dogs. They just said that his dogs tested positive for tramadol. And they changed this rule. He was not penalized, so he kept his race winnings from finishing in second place. He has since then been trying to fight to clear his name. And he released this video on YouTube the same day that he was named.
I have done nothing wrong. I have never knowingly broken any race rule. I have never given any banned substance to my dogs. But yet, out of the blue, I can be thrown under the bus this quick by the Iditarod, and they will do nothing to protect you.
There was also this press conference with his lawyer. Tegan, you were there. Set the scene for me a little bit.
Sure. So Dallas Seavey has hired Clint Campion, the former Anchorage district attorney, to represent him. So we had a handful of news cameras, and Clint Campion came out and said that we've had another toxicologist review the drug test results, and she says that her analysis proved that Dallas Seavey's dogs had to have been given tramadol after they finished the race. In fact, she said at least 2 hours after they finished the race, which narrows the timeline that the Iditarod gave us. The Iditarod said it could have been anywhere from right up until they had the drug test, 6 hours after the Iditarod, all the way back in White Mountain, 77 miles away.
For Dallas, it's his reputation in the mushing community that is most important. And by revealing his name, there's this cloud of suspicion that's over his head that, you know, we're hopeful today that we can remove that cloud. But, you know, the likelihood is that he will always be associated with a positive test, regardless of the actual evidence.
It's not disputed from what she found that the dogs had tramadol in their system. It just narrowed the window, you know, where they could have been given it, which to me was interesting because it sounded like it was sort of branded as this, you know, Dallas is not implicated in any wrongdoing. And there really wasn't an allegation of wrongdoing. There was just this sort of nebulous, when could this have happened? And it just kind of, you know, reduced the window.
And that was kind of the main takeaway, I think, you know, that she was narrowing that window to a period that would have had to have been after the race finish, because Dallas has said this. I think other mushers have said it must have been sabotage. Somebody must have dosed his dogs with tramadol to try to sabotage his race. But nobody's really pointed to like who that could have been.
There's lots of speculation on Musher Facebook and places like that.
Lots of speculation. And that's the one thing in this report that seems to support that idea. If you agree with their interpretation of this. There were a few other things, I think, in this independent outside toxicologist review, which, by the way, was just a review of the toxicology findings that the Iditarod made. There was no additional testing done or anything like that. But she did poke holes in kind of the findings of the Iditarod's toxicologist and questioned his credibility. And she was just sort of doing this out of the kindness of her own heart, right?
That's what she told us. She said that she was an Iditarod fan. She had come up for the 2017 Iditarod, and her grandchildren rode in the sleds of mushers during the Anchorage ceremonial start. And she said she heard about this drug testing controversy and offered her services.
And I'll say, for me, at this point, the whodunit is kind of less interesting than the fallout from it. And I think that gets us into one of the other major developments in the last few months, which is the Foraker report that was commissioned to look into that, which also faulted the board for how they've handled not just this, but several other matters in the last few years, including rule changes and how they were communicated, how conflicts of interest have been dealt with. And part of the reason the Foraker report was commissioned in the first place was because there was so much bad press around Musher X and how the doping scandal rolled out.
This report was not supposed to be made public, right?
Correct. This was a report that was asked for by the Iditarod's top sponsors, and then it got leaked to reporters.
And one of their findings was to maybe, for the Iditarod to avoid losing sponsors, they were going to need to do some things recommended in this report. One of those was that the several board members with conflicts of interest were going to need to step down at some point. What else was in that report?
I think for me, the major sort of, you know, the headline at the top was that the race is not viable long term in the way that it's currently going, that because of what they say is some mismanagement or mishandling by the board, sponsors aren't going to want to, you know, chip in money to make this happen. And because major sponsorship is the really big, like by far the biggest revenue source for the race, that's really in jeopardy. They also point out that a lot of the race is handled and made possible by volunteer labor. Plenty of people have experience with the Iditarod because they come up, they volunteer their time, they go out to a checkpoint, they just help with all manner of things. And if there's not buy-in from fans, if people don't trust the race, if they don't trust the board, if they sour on it, that labor goes away, and it's really not feasible to pull off this massive effort that stretches more than 1,000 miles without that. So those were some bigger ones. They also mentioned that the board has soured relationships with a lot of the mushers, and that's something that we saw in not long afterwards with the official finishers letter. So there was a lot in that report. To me, it's really meaningful that the sponsors commissioned it and sent out surveys and did interviews with a lot of the people that were affiliated. It seems like a very credible report.
They definitely seem to have done their due diligence in looking at various aspects of this race and what might need to be corrected for it to be, like you said, viable in the future.
Right, and there were suggestions about what they could do. And the response I got from Iditarod when I was kind of doing my reporting and asking them for a statement was, we take this report seriously. We are not going to enact any of the changes yet. We want to get through the race in March, and then by the summer, we're going to start looking at making some of those changes. Tegan, I'd be curious to hear from you. I read that as we agree. We think that there needs to be some changes. We do not have the capacity to handle that right now because this is happening at the busiest time of year for us, right before our marquee event. But we will begin to look at making those reforms and put them into practice.
That was my takeaway as well, that the board acknowledged the report, acknowledged its findings, and said it planned to deal with it after the race was completed. And I think the Iditarod has said that. And I think we heard that again from Andy Baker at the recent board meeting. A group of mushers had called for him to step down, and he said, I'm going to stay on the board. The board agreed that he stay, and they said they'll deal with it after the race is finished.
We actually have some tape from that press conference. We asked Baker after he came out of that closed-door session about this letter from the Iditarod Official Finishers Club, and it starts out here with him explaining why he thinks the club wants him to step down.
There's so much emotion, and there's so much emotion this time of year with the mushers are getting ready for the race. There's so much to do, and everybody wants the race to do well. So I took it very positively. Everybody wants the race to do better, and the board, our whole focus is we want to have a safe race. We want dogs to be safe. We want mushers to be safe, and we want a successful race that everybody has a good time, and it's good for Alaska and good, and again, with dog safety. Number one is dog safety.
Can you talk about, so this statement that came out today says that you're planning to stay as the head of the board. The IOFC sent that letter asking for you to resign. Can you talk about why you are the best person to serve as the president of the board?
I think we have a lot of good people on the board that could do a better job than myself. So I'm not the only one by far, but I think we have a very strong board that has worked together and works very well together, and it's not one person making the decisions. So so that it's not as much as me leading as the board works together. So they felt that they want to continue with the same message. And
he seemed kind of emotional coming out of that closed door meeting. I'm just going to guess that that has to do with the board actually backing him up, that they weren't going to bow down to this group of mushers that may or may not represent the larger official finishers club. Tegan, what was your takeaway from that?
Yeah, I agree. Andy Baker came out and seemed to be happy that he had the unanimous support from the board. That was highlighted that it was a unanimous decision by the board of directors to keep him. He talked about how important the race was for him as an adult and growing up in rural Alaska. His brother, John Baker, was the musher who won the 2011 Iditarod. And Andy Baker talked about how this was just his way to be involved in the race and how he liked having both business people and folks with links to the Iditarod on the board of directors.
The Finishers Club had asked for the resignations of other board members. They wanted Andy to step down pretty much immediately. I think they set a deadline there that, of course, was not met because he didn't step down. But Andy, when he was talking to us in that sort of impromptu press conference, he didn't rule that out. He just wasn't going to do it before the race, right?
Correct. Yeah, he's said again, we're going to deal with this after the 2018 Iditarod has passed. We'll take this up again in April. So we'll see what happens.
A big part of this, some of these interrelated controversies, and especially with the Foraker report, has to do with sponsors. And people who follow this have probably already heard in the last few months that some of the most prominent sponsors have left the race. Zach, this is where we're going to talk about PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And they have long fought the Iditarod. They may be glad to see sponsors leaving the race. Are they getting traction? Are they convincing sponsors to leave the Iditarod?
Yes. I mean, to that and more. PETA has really stepped up its efforts against the Iditarod. I was actually talking not long ago to one of the communications directors for them. And, you know, she's very candid that getting sponsors to leave the race is a big part of their strategy. And I actually have a little bit of tape that I pulled of her kind of rattling off just how many companies have really decided not to re-up their relationship with the Iditarod.
Well, PETA has long contacted sponsors and asked them to stop sponsoring this deadly race, to stop paying for these dogs to be run to death. There are a number of companies that have pulled out just within the last number of years: Costco, Maxwell House, Nestle, Pizza Hut, Rite Aid, Safeway, the Transportation Security Administration. They all pulled their sponsorships.
Now, not all of those are major sponsors. That, I should say, is Colleen O'Brien with PETA. We spoke on the phone about all of their efforts this year. And like I said, they're really ramping up what they're doing. That includes that, you know, for the first time in the organization's history, and it's very antagonistic relationship with the Iditarod, they're coming to Alaska. Miss O'Brien called it, you know, coming into the lion's den. This year, they'll be at the ceremonial start in Anchorage. I believe they're also trying to go to Willow, and they will have a presence in Nome. I will be really curious on the ceremonial start how that plays out. It's definitely not a crowd that's particularly receptive to PETA's message. And in Nome, I mean, that the town really loves and depends on the race. And so it's I don't know what to expect. Tegan, do you know what to expect?
I have no idea, but I am also intrigued to see how this all plays out.
And PETA takes a little bit of credit for some of the duress that the Iditarod is under right now. Miss O'Brien alluded to a diminished race purse this year and connects that to flight from sponsors and says, look, our efforts getting people to stop supporting the race, that is having a direct impact on how financially viable it is, how lucrative it is to race here. We're winning ground on this front. I have another piece of tape about the kind of view that PETA takes about mushing in general.
One of the biggest lies that the Iditarod community and the mushing community has tried to sell the public is that these dogs aren't like the dogs we share our homes with. They don't have the same needs, and it's not true. These dogs have the same needs and desires as the dogs we share our homes with. So in one sense, it is a bit diluted.
And so what she's alluding to there is the explanation from mushers that, look, these are working animals. They are bred for this. They are happy doing this. And she and a lot of PETA and a lot of hardcore animal rights advocates will say, no, they're not. Dogs are indoor animals. They want to be with other dogs playing at the dog park. They want to be inside. It is cruel in this day and age when we don't have to force them into work. And that includes the stress and strain and competition of a race like the Iditarod. They would like to see no dogs in the Iditarod, and there's really not a lot of wiggle room in their position on that. And, you know, PETA is really stepping up its efforts this year and going forward.
Is there any way to know if they've actually been successful in deterring sponsors from this race?
I think one thing we have seen is Wells Fargo, one of the Iditarod's top sponsors, dropping out. Wells Fargo did not say that it was because of PETA. However, the Iditarod came out with its own statement saying that false information spread by animal rights organizations had prompted Wells Fargo to drop its sponsorship.
We've kind of covered a lot here in terms of the controversy in the off season here for the Iditarod. Does this feel different this year for some reason?
Yes. Yeah, I would say it feels much less about the race itself and a lot more about the event and the status of dog mushing in Alaska. This feels like a very different year. This feels unique.
I agree. This is by far the most controversy I've seen in my time here swirl around the Iditarod. And like Zach said, it feels like there's several black clouds and they haven't left the horizon. They're still here and the race will probably start underneath them.
That seems like a good spot to leave off. Thanks to Tegan Hanlon and Zachariah Hughes for joining me today. Please stay tuned for our next episode. It'll be dropping soon. You can subscribe to the Iditapod at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen online at alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove. Catch you next time, and until then, happy trails.
Therapy horses?
Also therapy horses on the occasion. It's a little bit of everything. Yes.
Are you officially on the animal beat, or is that just like you've carved that out?
I think it's a personal interest that I've carved out, yes.
Dogs with jobs is a subset there.
Miniature horses with jobs.
Miniature horses with jobs.
Bears with mischief.
Yeah.
All of the above.